Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in Kawasaki v. Thompson.
May it please the court, Mr. D.J. Kelly Jr. will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'm here today with my partner, Glenn Johnson, on behalf of the petitioners, Kawasaki Motors Corporation, USA, and Kawasaki Heavy Industries Limited. You may hear me refer to those companies as KMC and KHI shortly. This case was tried in November 1990, the jury verdict and judgment for my clients. The 5th District Court of Appeals in Dallas reversed the trial court in December of 1991 on the basis that petitioners had failed to supplement an interrogatory concerning expert witnesses, and the basis of that testimony caused harmful error in the trial court. The Court of Appeals opinion since that time has been frequently cited in seminars and various Court of Appeals opinions on various issues. So the petitioners are here today to say, that case viewed in its entirety, it stands for two principles, fairness and trial by ambush. Now, I don't mean fairness in a concept, in an abstract concept. I mean it in the sense of this court's opinion in Transamerica v. Powell and its more recent decision, Smith v. Southwest Feed Yards. Petitioners are well aware of the court's past dealings with Rule 215.5, and the exception to it is a good cause exception. However, the 15 opinions that the court has written on the subject, none even approximated the trial scenario before the trial court in this case. And given this court's more recent opinions in Bion, Smith, West Texas Gathering, and Bullock, we believe the court should now apply the same principles of fairness and reverse the Court of Appeals decision.
Mr. Johnson, do you concede that the Thompsons asked for a summary of any expert testimony? Do you concede that they asked for a summary of expert testimony?
Well, there was an interrogatory, a specific set of interrogatories that was first submitted to petitioners in this case. It was a set of interrogatories consisting of some 360 separate questions. At the time that petitioners received that set of interrogatories, we filed a motion for protective order. And then the protective order was then heard by the trial court in January 1989.
Okay, I'm familiar with that. I mean, part of your argument is, it seems to me, that because of a subsequent order that was entered, we just disregard all those earlier questions, and then there was no question left. But is it critical to your argument that there was no question asking for a summary of the expert's testimony?
Well, I believe if this case is evaluated as a good cause case, it's one set of facts. If there's no interrogatory operational, then it's not a good cause case. Protective order did away with that operational interrogatory, and there was no supplemental expert interrogatory needed to be answered by petitioners.
Okay, that is our position. If we go to then the good cause scenario, that there was an interrogatory operational. And from that point, then, for the purpose of argument, you would say, yes, there was an interrogatory asking for the summary, but we showed good cause for not having summarized it.
Yes, Your Honor, there are probably six factors that are in the record showing good cause, plus there's the showing that we made at the time of trial. I must admit, at the time that this issue came up, respondent had rested his case in chief. The objection was made at the time, right previous to the time that petitioners put on their direct case. And the objection was to any expert testimony at all being admitted by the court. It wasn't specific as to the particular expert witnesses being offered at trial. It was a general objection, almost in the sense of a motion in limine, to eliminate all expert testimony on behalf of the petitioners. There was never any specific objection made. At that time, we were surprised. It was a reverse trial by ambush. We were the ones surprised. We made a showing of good cause at that time. The trial judge took about 10 minutes to overrule the objection. It wasn't a sense that we recessed, go back and argue. We had to make our showing at that very moment. And we told the court, Your Honor, there's a protective order outstanding in this matter that has eliminated that expert interrogatory. In fact, I think the record clearly shows that throughout the trial, the supplemented or whatever the amended interrogatories that superseded the first set of interrogatories were the operational interrogatories that, in fact, responded, filed several motions to compel against petitioners to force us to answer those in more specifics, and also filed several motions for sanctions concerning that separate set of interrogatories, which was the amended set the protective order applied to. The first set of interrogatories, where that expert interrogatory was never again addressed by the trial court. The first time we heard about it was after the respondent had rested their case in direct, before we put on our case in chief. That was the only time that we had an opportunity to make a showing of good cause, and at that time we told the trial court Your Honor, those interrogatories were amended and superseded, and, Your Honor, in the second set of interrogatories filed by respondents, we filed sworn answers to fact designations with questions that were in those second set of interrogatories, identifying both the experts that testified later in trial. And they were not only identified by name and address, they're also identified as experts. And below their names, it was stated that they were experts in our trial. Also, they're listed in response to some four or five other contention interrogatories in that second set of interrogatories. And that was before the court as well, and we identified that response as well. But I still think the court's previous opinions show that it's not only the showing that we make, but the Court of Appeals also has to look at the record in its totality. I believe that was stated in the Sharp versus Broadway case. And this court, this trial court, had not only those two things I mentioned to you before at the time, it also had for the two expert depositions that were taken of these two witnesses over a year before trial, one in California, one in Texas. Both of the expert depositions were taken by respondent. The court also had all of these various motions for sanctions that all applied to the second set of, what I call the second set of interrogatories, which was amended and superseded. That was before the trial court. There was a designation of experts made by our co-counsel and co-defendant in the case, Gainesville Cycles, which named Kawasaki's experts as their own experts.
You've indicated in your argument already that you view avoiding trial by ambush as an important objective.
Well, I believe in reading the court's opinions, I believe that's one of the primary objectives in the Rule 166.
What rule of law should we announce here to ensure that we're not opening the door to trial by ambush?
Well, we came in the sense that the rule itself is not objectionable. I believe it serves the purposes that it was there to do. It's protect litigants from the discovery abuse, prevent trial by ambush. And I believe it gives fair notice in the event the party does not supplement their interrogatories that they are going to be sanctioned. But in this case, where the identification and all the information is given to the other side, I believe at some point the good cause exception has to mean something.
Well, it's that point I'm trying to ascertain. You're basically saying that we have a basis for a reasonable exception here based on what happened, and you have some compelling arguments in that regard. But in terms of what the rule of law should be, is it that if you've taken depositions before, that's enough?
No, you're not at all. I believe the previous opinions have shown that that's not enough. And our written designation of experts, let me add that as well to the other set, one other fact that the court had in front of it. We had filed a written designation of experts
right.
with the trial court because we didn't believe we had an active interrogatory on the subject. We were facing an early trial date, which is a trial date set a year before the actual trial went forward. But we had to come forward under what we believe was a designation of experts requirement 30 days before trial, so we filed a written designation. It was not sworn.
Now, why did you believe you had to do that? If there was
we had an early trial date in the summer of 1989, which the trial actually went to trial in November of 1990. But I think what Justice Enoch earlier was talking about was a supplemental requirement that the respondent had filed asking us to designate experts. It was a general document filed to ask us to give all our supplementation to all of our discovery. It wasn't specific as to a specific interrogatory. Or specific as to any type of information, it was general. They wanted all supplemental information. Remember, a hearing was held on it because the trial date was passed. But that was why the original written designation was filed, because there was a trial date set.
Well, then is the rule of law that if a party has filed a written designation of experts with the court, that establishes good cause for the use of that expert?
Your Honor, if we're going to look at it in a good cause scenario, I think we have to look at it in the totality of the circumstances. If you pick apart the facts of our case, you'll end up where the Court of Appeals did. They picked it apart. They said, Sharp, deposition's not enough. Inadvertence of counsel, if you rely on a protective order that's not effective, that's not enough. If you rely on written designation of experts filed under tie court, that's not enough. If you pick it apart one by one, you can find a case that stands against that proposition almost in every case.
Well, what I'm concerned about is future action that picks apart the whole barrier we've erected against trial by ambush, and that's why I'm trying to get you to tell me, whether it's apart or together, what the rule of law is that this decision should stand for so that it will be clear to trial courts and future litigants on both sides of the docket that we're not going back to trial by ambush. And if you can try to enunciate what that rule of law is. I'll let you do it in your terms rather than trying to characterize it.
In my terms, I would probably go back to your terms in the West Texas Gathering case. Say adequate notice of the opponent's proof in a trial by the merits, not based on an advantage through discovery. That is what we're seeking through these rules. When that kind of information has been transmitted and communicated, and then I go to the Smith opinion where it says that the information once transmitted and communicated to the other side and experts have been identified or factors have been identified, that is enough.
Well, Smith is pretty narrow in the way it's drawn concerning individual parties who've been so designated. West Texas certainly does deal with not using the rules to ambush by rules. But in terms of just saying that our rule will be there's good cause if the other side knew about it, doesn't that get us right back to saying if a deposition was taken, that's enough? I mean, is a rule that says if the other side knew about it sufficiently general that it gets us right back to if the name happened to come out in the course of a deposition or any of these things, that's enough?
I understand, Justice Doggett. If we're going to narrowly define this case and very narrowly define it like I believe you have in the other cases, the most compelling set of facts with these petitioners is the fact that we relied on a court order and relied on that court order at the time we went to trial for what it stood for. And we believe the trial judge, made that court order stand for what it was there to do, was to supersede and amend those interrogatories. So to the extent there's a narrow rule to be applied here is that a protective order or a court order about which a party relies going to trial that has superseded previous interrogatories. In that case, good cause has been shown because the petitioners, in this case, never knew they had a supplemental interrogatory to answer. They went to trial on the basis that that protective order had superseded and amended those previous set of interrogatories. And I believe the conduct throughout the trial proceeding indicated that we had done that.
Is it possible that no one can state a rule of law that's broad enough to cover the inconsistencies that this court has handed down on this subject?
Well, Justice Cornyn, I'm aware of your dissent in the Smith case and the Biden case, and I understand your concerns. I do believe, though, when you originally drafted Rule 215.5, there was an awareness that at some point that rule, the mechanical application of that rule could lead to an injustice, and that's what's happened in this case. And the good cause exception has to mean something if there. And if there's ever been a set of compelling facts that show good cause, I believe it's this case. And if we don't show other litigants that good cause does mean something, give the trial court some discretion, then it means nothing. And if we want to narrowly draw it, and I know we want to narrowly draw it to prevent the good cause exception to swallow up the rule, and that's been your concern all along, I understand that. But it does have to mean something.
If the trial judge had ruled against you in this case and had not allowed this evidence in, would that have been an abuse of discretion that you could have appealed?
Well, yes, Your Honor, I believe it would have been. We had the...
Well, apart from your first argument, apart from the interrogatory, but on your good cause showing, do you believe you demonstrated good cause as a matter of law?
Our demonstration of good cause, and I believe the record will reflect it, is that the first time this issue came up, when I told you in between the two presentations of the two cases, my immediate reaction was, Your Honor, that interrogatory has been superseded. So in a large part, our good cause showing was based on what I just told you, the text order.
Well, I'm just wondering how much discretion you think we should leave to a trial judge on an issue such as this one, so that if the trial judge had ruled the other way, that would be something we shouldn't disturb.
Well, I believe the trial judge has the facts in front of him that the Court of Appeals can never understand, and he had all these facts I've given you. The trial judge, I don't believe, has a responsibility on the record of stating exactly why he applies good cause. I think he has to understand the entire record and make a statement on the record that he has found good cause. But I think it's unfair to this particular trial judge to make him go through all the various factors that he was weighing at the time that he made a good cause finding. But at the time that good cause was shown, we had also made a specific argument to the court that the second set of interrogatories, which were sworn answers on our behalf, specifically identified both of these two witnesses. And they were identified five separate times, and they were deposed over a year before trial. And in fact, at trial, respondent's counsel cross-examined them on the basis of their expert deposition testimony that had been given that previous year. He also voired the jury about the two experts that were going to testify. I believe respondent's counsel knew full well they'd be allowed to testify, Yet the Sharp opinion was handed down in between the time these depositions were taken and in between the time the case went to trial. When he saw that, he saw depositions don't necessarily constitute good cause. He saw an argument and hatched it. And that's what led to this ultimate argument at trial, I believe, because the Sharp opinion had not been handed down at the time this case was filed.
And I think going back to good cause, if I had an interrogatory out there that said, give me a summary of what your experts say, is it your view that the fact that you present the experts for the other side's deposition, where you don't ask them any questions in the deposition, do you think that's sufficient for them to glean from their cross-examination a summary of what your position with your experts will be?
I'm not meaning to say that. I believe that's just a factor in what's happened in this particular case. No, you cannot glean what we're going to ask our experts at trial.
So the real essence of your case, the good cause, is you had an order that superseded them, you understood it superseded them, and the fact that the appellate court now thinks you should not have thought that should not be a basis for setting aside the trial court's decision that was a good cause.
I believe that what has happened in this case is that respondent has been able to frame it in a good cause scenario. We never viewed it that way. We viewed the protective order that was entered into superseded and amended those interrogatories. And now that it is a good cause case, we've been framed that way. We felt compelled to come forward with all the good cause evidence, and also we made that showing in trial. But ultimately, I think, to go back to our real argument, it was that the protective order was there. And it was not inadvertence of counsel to rely on that protective order, because if you go back and look at what the protective order requested of the court, it requested the court to limit the scope and nature of the discovery, which when we received it was over 360 separate questions asked of a foreign company. It would have been virtually impossible to provide those kind of answers.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. J. Don Gordon will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Your honors, I believe his honor has correctly hit on the real issue in this case. If it was okay for these witnesses to testify at trial, these two experts to testify at trial and give their opinions, no other trial lawyer answering discovery in his right mind is going to answer Justice Enoch's question. And the question, the interrogatory that was asked, and I apologize for the quality of this, this is page 16 from the transcript, and I'm sure you can't read it because I can't read it from just a few feet away. But the interrogatory number 21 says, if the answer to the foregoing interrogatory is in the affirmative, and that was, have you hired any experts? State the name, last known address, and telephone number of each such experts, and the substance of the facts to which said expert is expected to testify, the opinion held by said expert, or experts to which they will testify, and the grounds of each opinion to which they will testify. That doesn't exactly track 166, but it's pretty close.
Was that a live interrogatory?
I contend it certainly was, Your Honor. This is from the first set of interrogatories.
Was there any of the information that you sought in that interrogatory that you didn't have when this trial began?
Your Honor, we'll never know, because I can only know that if I ask all the right questions in the deposition, and I submit that in expert depositions, it is virtually impossible to go, well, it's virtually impossible, it also doesn't make a lot of sense, to go around and try to really ferret out your opponent's position by taking experts' depositions.
I think you can do it better in an interrogatory than in a deposition?
I don't know that you can do it better. I think the two work hand in hand. As I see it, the interrogatory practice is to set the parameters of what the expert's opinion is going to be and the basis, so that I can go effectively take a deposition.
Well, as to the interrogatory you just read, you had everything in there except expert opinions in the designation of experts that was filed with the court, did you not?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, except the substance of their testimony. The designation says, these are who they are, and this is what their address and telephone number is.
And you had the opportunity to explore the experts' opinions as fully as you wanted to on the deposition?
As fully as I could, maybe not as I would have liked to. Experts today, I think as Justice Doggett observed in West Texas, they're almost a necessary part of what we do because life has become so complicated and technical. But a lot of experts, and I think this court is well aware of the fact, are not so much expert and witness as they are advocate. And that concerns advocate for their side's position.
Comparing the deposition that you took with their trial testimony, can you identify anything that they testified to at trial that was not revealed to you in the deposition?
I can tell the court in all fairness that there were some things that I did not know, but I cannot quote you what those are today. It has been too long and the testimony is too extensive.
Well, I'm sure the court would like would entertain some identification by a supplemental letter brief. If you can identify for us what that might be, that would be important, wouldn't it, in determining whether there was harmful error here?
Well, I think the issue of whether there is harmful error in terms of is there a reversal, in the way I look at it, comes after we determine whether or not the testimony should or should not have been admitted, and then if it's if everything they testified to at trial was something that was in the deposition, it would be tempting to say no harm, no foul. And that's what this court has been saying ought not be the rule. Just because nobody gets shot doesn't mean there's not an ambush.
But haven't we been?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I thought we had established the harmful error test in this area in the G case.
I think the court did.
And we've been applying that consistently. We've been silent on it prior to that time, and we applied that, I guess it was 1989.
And I think the Dallas Court of Appeals accurately addressed that issue. This case the trial lasted 10 days. Mm-hmm. It was hotly contested on liability and engineering issues and accident reconstruction. These two witnesses were the only people that testified on behalf of the defendants, the petitioners here, who gave opinions.
How do you respond to the argument that first set of interrogatories had been superseded?
It simply had not, Your Honor. There was initially, prior to the interrogatories being sent, we filed a motion to enlarge, simply because we felt a lot of information from an engineering and product development standpoint that was outside this country. And the only effective way to get it was through a very expansive set of interrogatories.
360?
Yes, Your Honor. And we filed a motion with the court. The court granted the motion. Then after we served the interrogatories, I think there were five that were not objected to. And the objection to this interrogatory is the one that says that the defendant objects to the extent that this question calls for something broader than the rules. Well, that's not an objection, the way I see it.
Well,
certainly
what did the court decide?
All right. A joint motion for protective order was filed by the two Kawasaki defendants, and we worked out an agreement, Mr. Johnson and I, after a long period of time, about what of that technical information and data they would produce and how they would produce it. There was never word mentioned one about experts. It wasn't what was being discussed. The trial court simply approved the agreement. The agreement is in the record.
Was there ever a supplemental answer to those interrogatories?
No, Your Honor. There never
was. So there were five answered and 355 objected to, and then you worked for several months and reached a deal.
On the technical issues.
And now The other 355 interrogatories were never answered. You never filed a motion to compel.
No, the agreement that Judge Fry approved was simply how the information sought in those 360s would be supplied. That's what the record says. On page 151 of the transcript, Mr. Johnson says that we have an agreement to the granting of the joint motion for protective order and the objection in lieu of those interrogatories described in the following agreement. This agreement was limited to the issues that we had discussed.
But you never filed a motion to compel. There was this objection. You can say it's baseless, and maybe we agree, maybe we don't. But anyway, questions 20 and 21 were posed. 21 was objected to, and 20, I guess, was not yet or something.
20 was said we have retained no experts at this time.
And 21 was objected to, and you never filed a motion to compel.
Simply, Your Honor, I don't view that as an objection that puts the burden on me to, because it doesn't
matter. Didn't we write a case back in 1999 that said it was on you, even if the objection was frivolous?
I'm sorry?
Don't we have an opinion?
Yes, Your Honor.
Sorry, I've forgotten the name of it.
I think it's the McKinney case.
McKinney, yes.
But the problem is, this is a conditional objection. It says we only object to the extent this request calls for something broader than the rules. As long as what I was asking for was what Rule 166 says I'm entitled to, by its terms, it's not an objection.
Well, were any of these precise questions then ever subsequently answered?
No, Your Honor.
And then you sent out a second set of interrogatories.
We sent out another set of interrogatories that dealt with other things.
But did not inquire about expert witnesses?
No, Your Honor, because this is what we did do. Now, the interrogatories were served in October of 88. That answer or response was filed in December of 88. In January of 89 was when the agreement was approved by the court. 7 months later, in July of 1989, I sent a new request for supplemental responses. Now, Mr. Kelly has indicated that this was a vague, general request to supplement everything. Item number 3 says, furthermore, plaintiffs specifically request that you respond to all plaintiffs' requests for discovery regarding expert witnesses, not more than 30 days after service of this request, nor less than 30 days prior to the beginning of trial, whichever is time period is less. Your Honor, I cannot.
Now, was that your second set of interrogatories?
No, Your Honor. This is not part of the second set.
Did this come after the second set?
Actually, it was served almost in the same week. These were served at about the same time.
My precise question is, did it come just after or just before?
I believe it was just after.
When in relation to those interrogatories was the unsworn designation of experts made?
Probably 2 weeks before, if memory serves me correctly.
The designation was made before this or after 2 weeks after?
My recollection is it was before this. And the answer to someone's question, and maybe it was the Chief Justice's, about why was that done, was simply because the pretrial order that the trial judge was using at that time had a cutoff time in it. It had a specific place in it that said you got to identify experts by such and such a day. That's
under Rule 166 order.
Under Rule 166. It didn't require...
Did it require a sworn answer? Or
no. It just said you've got to identify them, and it doesn't require the disclosure of opinions or the basis of opinions or anything like that.
Why wasn't opposing counsel then able to rely on that order, as he suggested, a more narrow rule for us, of law for us to announce here, but in a circumstance where there was such an order entered after these interrogatories concerning the designation of experts, that he was able to rely on that order?
Because the agreement and the judge's order simply saying I approve the agreement didn't deal with experts in any way. It's by its very terms limited the effect of the agreement to the items that we talked about. By its very terms, it was limited to that. If that were not the case, why send this request that they supplement their answers? And the reason we sent that is that we had been told about these experts and were trying to schedule depositions, and I needed my interrogatory answer and I couldn't get it answered. Now, with respect to the overall idea of fairness in ambush and that sort of thing, when we went to trial in this case, the last case out of this court was Rainbow. I thought it was as clear as anything could possibly be at that time that if that those interrogatories were not answered, that those persons would not testify. As close as we have to a description or definition, if you will, of good cause, I believe is in Alvarado, where it talks about in either difficult, unusual, or impossible circumstances, or words to that effect. What we have here is nothing more, Your Honors, than another situation where counsel ignored my supplemental request and now says that it was because those interrogatories did not exist. I have trouble accepting that as a good faith argument simply because I was there, I negotiated the agreement, I know what we talked about. We didn't talk about experts.
One of the reasons that deposition is not enough is because you don't know when you take a deposition whether the witness is going to testify at trial or not. And part of the purpose of asking the question is to find out not only who is out there, but who is going to testify at trial. But you had that information in the pretrial order, and you had the opportunity to find out the opinions in the deposition. What were you missing?
What I was missing, Your Honor, in terms of the answer to that question, is whatever opinions and bases for those opinions that those experts may have had that either I forgot to ask, didn't know to ask, or counsel didn't solicit, the defendants didn't solicit at trial simply because they would have been beneficial to us.
Did any of that come to light at trial?
As Justice Cornyn inquired, there were some things that came up that we didn't know. I'm not fleshing up on the record at this point in time to tell you exactly what they are.
But as a practical matter, doesn't a lawyer answer interrogatories? I mean, isn't a deposition a lot better because you can get face-to-face with the expert and quiz them about their opinions rather than have it filtered through your opposing counsel, as answers to interrogatories invariably are?
Your Honor, I don't argue that one is better than the other. They serve two different purposes. The interrogatory is the safety net. It sets the parameters. It lets me know, well, first of all, it lets me know if I even want to go take the expert's deposition. If they don't answer the question, then I'm to the expense and the trouble of maybe going and finding out. There's one expert in Texas that testifies all the time anymore that nobody even bothers to depose. They just say, send me the doctor's report. And my fear is, and my concern, is that
If you were worried about this deposition expense, you could have filed a motion to compel a response to interrogatory number 21. If the judge had thought that was a valid set of interrogatories, he could have ordered it answered. You could have seen that statement of what the experts want to say and then made the decision which
clearly,
to undergo.
Clearly, we could have, Your Honor, but the burden, I do not believe, should be on the person that is entitled to the interrogatory answer to keep going back and going back and going back and dragging that information out. As counsel has indicated, this was a very bitter and acrimonious discovery battle from word, you know, from beginning to end. Sanctions were imposed. Witnesses were brought back from Japan at the order of the court. A lot of things happened here, but I believe that we are standing at the precipice of the slippery slope with this case, because if it was okay for this interrogatory to be ignored, then I don't know if any way we'll ever be able to articulate a rule. We need as much certainty as we can down in the trenches.
Ms. Gordon, did you in fact, on the presentation of your case in chief, use the depositions of these experts?
Oh, no, Your Honor.
Maybe I misunderstood. I thought Mr. Johnson said that during the presentation of your case, you even cross-examined, used this deposition as part of the cross-examination of the experts.
No, I believe what counsel was referring to was simply my use of the depositions to cross-examine the witnesses during their case in chief. We did not offer any of the deposition testimony at all. I mean, this isn't, what is it, bullet, sort of like that. This is not that. And the other thing is that concerns me very much, this is a most difficult process for the court because it seems like the court has necessarily been trying to make a fair rule by opinion. We're all well aware of the fact that the rules process in the committee is working and struggling mightily with this. I submit that before we change any more, we ought to let that process begin, because it is very difficult down at the trial court level to really know what's going on. And the last thing is, in terms of what happened or how were we harmed, maybe, when we sat down in our final trial preparation and looked at the state of the law after Rainbow and what the defendants had done in this case, we assumed, and I think justifiably, that these experts would not testify. We put our case on that way. We responded to their settlement overtures that way, or with that belief. And we should certainly have been entitled to rely on what appeared to be the law and what was the law in October of 1990.
Were these the only two experts?
They were the only two experts that were offered by Kawasaki. The highway patrol was testified by deposition. There was some dispute over that. The trial judge allowed the highway patrolman to some opinions that he could have considered to be appropriate opinions from a lay witness to come in, and excluded opinions that would have gone beyond what a lay witness would have given. Expert witnesses present a different problem.
Were the only expert witnesses called by Kawasaki the two that are in dispute?
Yes, Your Honor, with the exception.
So you assumed they were going to go to trial without any expert
witnesses? We had no idea. You know, they hadn't answered the interrogatory. Those are the ones that we had deposed.
So you're saying the supplemental designation was the unsworn designation of these experts should not be considered a response to any discovery request?
Well, at least it's not a full response because it doesn't contain the opinions, but whether it should be considered at all or not gets us into whether or not unsworn supplementation to the interrogatories is appropriate. And quite honestly, I have a bit of a problem with the concept that it's okay that it's supplemental interrogatory answers don't have to be sworn, because I can see room for a tremendous amount of gamesmanship if a lawyer can just file things that his client doesn't have to swear to. But, of course, there are a certain number of cases out there that hold on this specific issue that a letter counts or something that doesn't comply with the interrogatory is not a sufficient supplementation. And I believe that's what the law was in 1990 when we tried the case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I believe what you've seen today is the full circle of the 215-5 sanction turned upside down. The ambush has been placed upon petitioners now, and it now is our responsibility to respond to an argument that now is clearly form over substance of these experts' testimony, their identification. All of the information that was required in those interrogatories was supplied to the respondent well over a year before trial. In fact, if you take respondent's argument and look at the interrogatories that we were served originally, the 360 interrogatories, and then were superseded and supplemented by a set of interrogatories that we answered fully, and we answered three or four supplemental times on request by respondent, And then we got another set of interrogatories in that we answered fully, and we're also moved to compelled to answer those more fully by respondent in front of the court, and then he requested sanctions for our failure to do so. You would now have three separate sets of interrogatories. What were we to do? Go back to the first set, put a separate set of interrogatory answers to those, separate sets of interrogatory answers to the second, the ones that superseded those, and then a third set of interrogatories. The protective order would have meant nothing in that case, nothing at all. I think to look at the form over substance argument, you have to look at how respondent handled his objection at trial. He did not object to the substance of the testimony of the experts when it was offered at trial, as is required by this court in Clark versus Trailways. He only made a general broad form objection prior to any witness being called, after he had closed, to having any expert of Kawasaki testify at trial. He relied entirely upon his ability to block us from bringing any expert to testify. And I think it's very significant that Trooper Collins, who was another expert we had named in response to the second set of interrogatories, the court went into great length to try to determine whether Trooper Collins would be allowed to testify. But what we ultimately did, and since he was also designated as a fact witness, we didn't want to call him for any expert opinions. We eliminated any expert opinions and brought him as a fact witness. It's clear that both Mr. McKibben and Dr. Hurt could have testified at trial as fact witnesses without any objection, because they were identified. But they were also identified as expert witnesses in the same set of interrogatories that designated them as fact witnesses.
As to the narrow basis for this opinion that we talked about earlier, based on your reliance on the protective order, can you respond to opposing counsel's contention that that order did not deal with these subjects of experts? Deal with these subjects of experts?
Well, then I would say, Justice Doggett, that we went to the trial court prepared to put on evidence on the protective order. Protective order was broad. It requested the court to limit the subject nature and the amount of information to be supplied in response to respondents' first set of interrogatories. And you can see in our brief that it details what we requested. We got to the trial judge with our witnesses prepared to put on a record. The judge asked us to go back to Mr. Gordon's office and work out an agreement. He didn't want to hear all this evidence because it would have been lengthy. Mr. Johnson and Mr. Gordon went back to Mr. Gordon's office, worked out the agreement, spent a long time working it out, came back to the trial court. Mr. Johnson read the agreement into the record. Mr. Gordon said, "I agree, Your Honor," and the court approved the agreement. The reason the expert interrogatories were not included in that information is because it did come up as part of their agreement. This superseding set of interrogatories that they agreed upon was going to be the first set. If we had had the responsibility to go back then at that point and go back and pick and choose every single interrogatory that was not covered in the superseded set of interrogatories, we would have had basically to go back and answer about 350 questions. And the protective order would have meant nothing to us. The whole purpose was to supersede those interrogatories. And believe me, when we heard the objection at trial, we were greatly surprised. And we believed we were the ones being ambushed because we had never heard the objection at all prior to that time.
Any?
I was just responding to this. But I think it's interesting to note what the trial judge said at the time when the respondent filed a motion for a new trial on this very subject. And the trial judge, and I'll just quote from the record what he said. He said, "If that is not good cause, then the Supreme Court should quit telling trial courts that we have some discretion in matters. If that is not good cause, then we don't have any discretion at all." I believe the trial court was moved by the compelling set of facts in front of him and could not frankly believe himself that he was being asked to make that ruling. We were surprised. The trial judge was surprised. The only one not surprised was Mr. Gordon, who had all the information. He was not ambushed at trial, yet here we are today telling you that he didn't have all the information. I couldn't ask him all the stuff I needed in the deposition. I needed more information in the discovery. I needed a form answer to an interrogatory, even though all the information requested in that form interrogatory was already in front of me.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tom. And that concludes the argument. In the second call, the court will take another brief recess.
Yeah,